And we're back. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And we have with us our guest, Gerald Friesen. He taught Canadian history, University of Manitoba, from 1970 to 2011. He has written several books, including The Canadian Prairies, A History and Citizen Nations. He's a co-author of Immigrants in Prairie Cities, former president of the Canadian Historical Association. He was an advisor on CBC Radio Canada's television series, Canada, A People's History. I remember that one. He lives in Winnipeg, and he is the author of The Honorable John Norquay. I'm going to learn to say this while we're on. And the subtitle is The Indigenous Premier, Canadian Statesman. Gerald Friesen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Phil. It's good to be here.
Boy, this is my chance to learn, Woody Allen said, everything you wanted to know about Manitoba, but were afraid to ask. Really, truly, that is the case. This gentleman, the Honorable John Norquay, and if I mispronounce it, please correct, he, of course, is described as a Métis, and he was a premier. We're in a moment in history now where the only Métis premier, and as I understand it's honorable, is Louis Riel. And their dates are very almost the same. They were pure contemporaries, but very different stories. So he was in, is it St. Andrews he's from?
That's right, just north of Winnipeg, about 15 miles
so
north.
So what's significant about that community? How did he come get into history from St. Andrews?
Well, first of all, his name is, in Winnipeg, people say Norquay.
Norquay.
Yeah. In Calgary, I'm told that the mountain at Banff, Mount Norquay, which is more or less the way they say it in the Orkneys, where his grandfather is from. And so Norquay or Norquay is the classic Scots Orkney way of saying it. And he was born in St. Andrews to a mixed ancestry couple. That is, both his father and mother were of mixed ancestry. And one of his grandfathers was from the Orkney Islands. And that's why the St. Andrews link is important. So many of the Hudson's Bay Company employees were from the Orkneys. Mm-hmm. And they were hired because they were hardy and they could survive winters. And in the fur trade, they were laborers. And his grandfather was one of those. Mm-hmm. And so basically, he's a mixed ancestry, but English-speaking and Protestant. And so unlike today, where all the Métis are called Métis, and people link back to the French Catholic Machif-speaking peoples of Red River.
But you just used a word which I'm also fascinated by.
Machif?
Machif. Is that how you say it?
Machif? Machif, yes. And that's a French Ojibwe or Anishinaabe language. Norquay spoke an Orkney English when he was a kid called Bungie. Which is sort of the mixed ancestry equivalent of Machif, but not so fully formed as a language. Huh. And so it's described academically as a dialect only. But this St. Andrews colony was pretty large. There were a couple of thousand people who lived there in the 1840s and 50s. The French Machif-speaking peoples would have ended up being, by 1870, when Riel is important, about 6,000 in total. And the English, Bungie-speaking Protestants would have been about 3,500 or 4,000 in total. So a substantial Anglo-mixed ancestry group, of which Norquay was the leader by the 1870s.
That's I saw an expression that he and Riel were on opposite sides of the river.
That's also not quite. Yeah, it is true. It is true. Quite right. Riel comes from basically the east side of the river, the Catholic French capital of St. Boniface.
Yes.
And Norquay's parish, St. Andrew's, is on the west side of the river. But where St. Boniface is at the forks, St. Andrew's and the church, the parish, where Norquay was born, is, as I say, about 15, 20 miles north of there.
Yeah. Well, I'll just mention it. Of course, I'm going to be struggling all day with this, but Norquay this is, to me, fascinating because, of course, it's very hard to say Manitoba without somehow ending up talking about Riel.
Yeah.
But Riel's moment there passed, and there was a political struggle, and Ottawa threw its weight around, and they finally got themselves together. They elected, they formed a government, had premiers, and he was, what, the fifth premier. And he had a long run for a premier. He had 11 years of run. Am I right?
Yeah. Well, 9 years as premier. I think 18 in the legislature.
18 years.
Six more in the cabinet. So a very long run. Yeah. So Riel was only there really for 9 months as the honorary premier. He was called the president of the provisional government.
They used the word president, is it?
Yeah, he did. He was interested in the American system of government.
That's a very striking part of it. It's interesting how both he and Riel, both Norquay and Riel, had a little bit of connection or had to think about the states. Always that was, and this whole phenomenon in your book of the parts I've read, I'm looking forward to reading the whole book, brings this out because there's a phenomenon of being from the West and not liking Eastern dictation and thinking maybe there are other choices to be made. But just to go back on his youth, tell us, he was spotted as a bright young fellow, but it was the Anglicans, right? The Anglican Church. And as I read the story, they really, particularly the gentleman David Anderson, really influenced him.
That's true.
And the idea, and David Anderson is, I found intriguing to think about because he, as you describe him, he's very much a champion of the British Empire. So could you talk about how those two came together and how that shaped their thinking?
Well, two avenues here. Norquay himself, his mother died when he was two. His father died when he was eight. And so all of a sudden, the family had to be split up among relatives. And Norquay and one of his sisters went with a grandmother, a mixed ancestry woman herself, to the area right around St. John's in Winnipeg. Now, it was just called St. John's Parish at that time. The new bishop of St. John's Parish was David Anderson. He just arrived from an Oxford-educated series of parishes in England, a very distinguished young prospect, the church thought, to be a leader in Canada. And it happened that Anderson dropped in on Grandma Norquay. By then, she had remarried and was Grandma Spence, but she was in her 50s, and discovered John Norquay, 8 years old, reading by candlelight, classic sort of,
This is like an fiction. Abraham Lincoln story.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. And decided this was a bright young man to follow. So they made sure he got to a local parish school with a very good teacher who'd been to England, another mixed ancestry man. And he turned out to be the sharpest kid in the class, and they decided after an exam period in which the best students in Red River took part of the English-speaking contingent, they decided that Norquay was the smartest of them all, and they would give him a scholarship.
Wow.
£30 a year, which included tuition and food and residence. And for that, he had to look after the minister's horse. But
instead of being an outstanding football player, he was, yeah.
Yeah. And so this, you know, 3 years, possibly four, it's hard to tell at this late date, of serious education, calculus, two other kinds of math, Latin, Greek, history, Bible. So he learned an enormous amount.
And he was devout, right?
Oh, I think so.
To the end.
To the end.
It seemed like the big moments in his life, his Anglicanism was emphasized.
Very much. Exactly right. And my impression is that he was a very devout and raised his children, had a Sunday service in their home in the evening in which he read a long prayer and then spoke a little to them. So a very Anglican life, I would say.
Mm-hmm. To what extent did he imbibe some of the language of David Anderson? Maybe it was in the footnotes, but I love footnotes. And Anderson was quite an advocate. He was a missionary. I mean, he saw his work as missionary work, right? Yeah. And he saw the empire as extending Christian civilization. It was the old idea. I mean, it was absolute pure. Colonial good thoughts, which turn out to be not so good, but
that's right. And he was at the height, I would say, of the British Empire, one of the bastions. And in that same decade that they created a Red River province, they had a new province in South Africa, a new province in New Zealand, a new province in Australia, and, you know, new province in Singapore, new province in Hong Kong.
Which, by the way, I think you pointed out that he said it was called Victoria. Hong Kong was called Victoria.
That's right, in that period.
It was the least they could do for the Queen.
That's right.
We've got some islands here with some interesting people.
And Edmonton was called Fort Victoria, or at least near Edmonton. And indeed, in the Pas of Manitoba, there was a brief period where it was called Victoria. So this was the height of the British Empire, and Anderson was one of those missionaries setting up Anglicanism around the world. They thought they would take on Roman Catholicism and defeat it. They were aggressively Protestant evangelicals.
Yeah, and the matchup across the river was an ultramontane Catholic.
It was.
Which is, I would say, your almost exact opponent, or pure opponent. Right. And they both thought, okay, no, it's us. No, it's.
And Anderson took a very cautious, careful approach to the Catholics. He wasn't aggressively competitive, but he was definitely going to compete in every sphere in the Northwest, from Hudson Bay and James Bay on the east to the Rockies in the west. He traveled to all those districts. He tried to set up missions. He tried to recruit young men to go to those missions as ministers. So his idea was that he would create a Protestant West.
Mm-hmm. Their thinking, it's interesting, reading it, you could back up from the two principal known Métis leaders, Métis, Riel and Norquet. And behind them are two major, Bishop Taché.
Yes.
And then David Anderson.
David Anderson.
I would have loved to have been there for their little conversations if they ever met. I don't know if they did. But behind these, and then further, you have the indigenous issue. And by the way, we haven't really said, we say mixed with whom? I mean, my understanding is that Riel might have been with the Soto people?
Probably with Cree or family even Dene.
He said Scots Cree, right?
Norquay is Scots Cree.
They use that term.
They would say native Scots.
Oh, yeah, I misstated. Yeah, it's Riel who's Soto.
Yeah.
Riel
Soto. Well, possibly, but in fact, it's a complicated story in Riel's background. And he might have been Dene or Cree. or Soto, yes, Ojibwe, what we call Anishinaabe today.
Anishinaabe.
One-eighth, if you start trying to do fractions.
Yeah. When we're reading, and by the way, I want to tell the listeners, here's a comment on the book by Gary Doer, the premier of Manitoba, from 1999 to 2009. That's a good run, 10 years. The Honorable John Norkay is a magnificent book. Friesen meticulously documents Norkay's many accomplishments, larger-than-life character, and charisma. He paints a picture of a negotiator and orator who ably uses humor and personal stories to win support, especially in the minds, in the midst of the racism he faced. That's a very nice comment. But so, and the title of the book is The Honorable John Norkay, Indigenous Premier, Canadian Statesman, and we're speaking to Gerald Friesen, the author, who's recipient of that really nice comment by Gary Doer. We really have to have these books, don't we? I mean, because our understanding, here I am, I've read some of these things, but unfortunately, it seems to me we always, for my part, find that I'm always reading basically what turns out to be romance of the history and not the people. And I do have questions, like now in this issue of Indigenous representation, there's a kind of a notion we get, which is that, okay, we've said Métis, so now we're getting, say, Mr. Norkay or Riel, that's Indigenous. But I don't really know, I have the faintest idea, what the Indigenous leaders thought of them and to what extent did they think that their interests, the Cree, the Soto, yeah, whoever, I mean, they would say, yeah, that isn't that so-and-so's grandson, you know, and what's he doing for us? I mean, do you have a picture of what they were, their estimates of these gentlemen?
That's a very good question. I have bits and pieces, but for the most part, the First Nation, as we sometimes say, Indian is coming back as a term now.
And the Americans use it. Did they, as far Native as I know, American, they haven't abandoned it, have they?
Well, the Native American is often used, but Indian is still there.
Yeah.
And we still have what we call the Indian Act, which is the 1876 Act that runs
governs all relations of
their lives. But what did they think of Norkay? Well, they saw him as a cousin, therefore an ally, a nistau, which is another way of saying comrade or brother or mate. But
you use that term in the book. I mean, you discuss that at length.
By yes, because that's what Indigenous or mixed ancestry people would have talked to each other. It's a Cree word. Mm-hmm. And so they're saying that Norkay is a nistau. Literally, that means brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law, yeah.
And so that's the way to think.
Which in most cultures can mean almost anything, right?
Yes.
Oh, there's my brother-in-law. The rest of us are working. Go on. <You know. laughs>
Well, you can also say, though, that you're linked. Mm-hmm. You have a kinship link, and therefore one can hope for understanding and support.
Yes.
And a nistau is like that. Mm-hmm. So Norkay was a nistau to those Cree and Soto.
And he thought of himself that way.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
And he thought of himself as defending their interests. Mm-hmm. In 1885, when things were really tough in the Northwest and people were starving, and eventually in March, April, Riel led that second uprising. Mm-hmm. Norkay wrote to a federal cabinet minister to say, they'd rather fight and shoot you than starve to death.
Yeah, that's, I joined that group.
Exactly. So, you know, he had an alliance.
Those Indigenous fighters, I'm going to call them fighters, I don't even know who they were. One of them was named Wandering Spirit, the ones who hanged at the same time as Riel and forgotten in history.
Yeah.
They were starving.
Yes.
That's the one thing I've learned about looking into them. I read about Frog Lake, and I mean,
yeah.
They were so hungry that they were breaking into where the food was.
Exactly.
And they ended up having to kill a few guys standing in front of the door.
Yeah.
That's ugly stuff.
It was very serious in the period 1882 to 1886. There's just no question but that people like Norquay tried to make a case for greater support. Mm. And, of course, Riel was invited in by a group of them, by the way, most of whom were French Métis, but a few were Anglo Métis or mixed ancestry British Native Canadians.
Yeah.
And so Riel was invited in to the Northwest from Montana, where he was then living. Mm-hmm. And within 8 months, that war broke out, civil war between the people of the Northwest and Canada.
Yes. Yeah. And that, too, must have been a nightmare for Norquay, who, by the way, he's at the end of his run at that point as a premier, right?
He was still in office. He was still regarded as likely to continue.
He was a premier in Manitoba, and this was happening in Saskatchewan.
In the Northwest, exactly.
Northwest.
That's right.
By the way, well, let's get a picture of him. I mean, you've mentioned, I mean, and as Jerry Duer emphasized it as well, that this is a big guy. He's a humorous individual, and he said he had charisma. If you could flesh that out, I mean, he was what, 300 pounds?
Yes.
And he would command attention at a meeting.
He would certainly command attention. In those days, a tall man was 5'6", 5'7".
Oh, boy, that's me.
Okay. And in those days, he, at 6'1", 6'2", was half a foot taller.
Wow.
So he was big. But he was also large in the belly. He weighed 300, 310, ooh, sometimes 320 pounds. He was very strong. And he was amazingly adept, agile. He could canoe with the best of them. He could run distances. He could snowshoe distances.
Yeah.
He was one of those guys.
You become a legend doing, you know, when somebody says, that guy is 300 pounds and he can move.
Yeah.
You know, the NFL immediately takes an interest in such people.
Exactly. There's a story about him putting a moccasined foot above a door 6 feet high and stamping his foot above it. So he could move and
yes.
He could.
When I picture a guy like that, he must have had a tremendous voice.
He had a wonderful voice.
By the way, did he have an accent? A Scottish or what?
Well, remember he was learning Bungie as a child, mm-hmm. So a mixture of Scots and English. But then he went to Anderson School, where he would have had Oxford English. And so he would have learned Oxford English. And people who talked about the way he spoke.
Maybe did he use dialect? I mean, he's probably a guy who could put a lot of things into one speech, right?
He could do five or six languages aside from the Latin and Greek. He could talk Cree. He could talk Soto. He could talk French, English, and Bungie. So he could put anything into a speech. But he spoke apparently with a forceful and yet quiet tone. And
oh,
so
boy.
People found him, at first they could hear him, but also he could raise and lower. The modulations worked so well.
My gosh. Now, that would be an impressive. You could see why. I mean, here you have the brains. He's already been spotted. He's small. He wasn't 300 pounds when he was first seen, so he had the brains. And then he grew into a formidable looking and sounding individual. Now you describe, he had successes and he came to a rough end, but it wasn't the most important matter with him as premier in terms of his success, is that he inherited a flow of immigrants. The population just exploded while he was premier.
That's correct. When he entered the legislature, there were 10,000 people in Manitoba, maybe 12,000. When he died in 1889, there were 140,000 people. So it had increased 10 to 15 times in population. And over a much larger span.
And who's going to pay for this? And how's it? Where's the resources going to come from?
And that is a crucial question.
And him and the East had problems.
And John A. Macdonald said, "I want to control the West. I want to own that land and decide how it will be distributed."
Of course.
The people of Red River said, "It's our land, and we want to control it." Macdonald had the troops. He imposed the laws. And
he built a railroad.
He built a railroad. He set up the survey. He sent the Mounties. And so they ran essentially the Western Interior as a federal province.
And now that's the number one issue, right? The Canadian Pacific Railroad was a monopoly, and to protect his people and also to get a piece of the action, he didn't want it to be a monopoly. And it just turns into vertigo because he says he's going to get a second rail, what they call it, the Red River Rail.
That's it.
And it was going to go to Minnesota.
That's right, to St. Paul, Minnesota.
That must have rang a bell in Ottawa. They didn't want a railroad then.
They did not. And it rang a bell in Montreal, the Canadian Pacific headquarters. They liked their monopoly and wanted to keep it. And the contract said they could have it for 10 years. And so from 1881 to 91. And here's Norquay in 1886-7. With all those thousands of new farmers out in the prairies wanting access to a line that would get their goods to market so they could survive.
Yeah.
So Norquay said, "Yes, I'll give you a competitive railway, the Red River Valley Railway. I'll own it as a Manitoba government project, and it will compete with the CPR." And the CPR said, "No way." But at the same time, they knew they were going to have to give it up. And so the president of the CPR said, "The hell with Canada. I'm not going to stay here any longer. I'm going to Minnesota. I'm going to join James J. Hill of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and we're going to build a railway from Minneapolis to Seattle, the Northern Pacific. And that's where I'm putting my money. So you, John A. Macdonald."
Oh, boy.
"So you, John A. Macdonald, fix my railway now. Give me some more money, and I'm leaving you."
Isn't that lovely? What a story. Oh, by the way, the title of this book, The Honorable John Norquay, he fought like a tiger, but he knew he was beat, right?
He hoped he could win all the way along. He went to Chicago, he went to New York, he went to Toronto and Montreal looking for money for the railway.
But they all turned him away.
Because Macdonald and the CPR had been there ahead of him.
What about the one other issue? Am I misunderstanding? Did they take a big piece of Manitoba away from them, give it to Ontario? And again, it was John A. not protecting Manitoba.
And you can't blame John A. for this one, but
does Norquay get into this? Where's he?
Yes, Manitoba fought Ontario over where the boundary should be. And Ontario said it should be where it is now, Lake of the Woods. Manitoba said it should be Thunder Bay. Manitoba should have 400 more miles eastward.
Yeah.
And so Macdonald didn't want to get involved because Ontario's premier, Oliver Mowat, was a very strong guy and they were having lots of fights.
Yeah.
So they said, "Let's go to the British highest court, Judicial Committee of the Privy Council of Great Britain, and it would decide." Oliver Mowat, Premier of Ontario, went to fight the case for Ontario, and Norquay did not go because he didn't have Mowat's skill as a lawyer, and Mowat won. And so Ontario got that extra...
Well, he was also less an Anglican than Mowat, I assume.
Mowat was effective. That was the important thing.
Yeah. Well, it's a very eloquent story, very important story. And His accomplishments have been, until now, at least for most of us, been lost. I hope this book, what kind of, are you getting reaction? I mean, is it starting, the book is just now out, right?
That's just coming out now, and there have been a few reactions. John English was one of the referees, and I've just discovered that recently. He was a silent referee, and he gave it a very glowing review. Mm-hmm. And Gary Dewar read it and said a glowing review. Mm-hmm. So it's now about to be launched, and we'll find out whether people find it interesting. Of course, I hope they do.
They've got to, in my opinion. I mean, just if we're going to say Métis, and it'd be so much part of our conversation, then the man who was a Métis who was premier for 11 years – and was involved in the big ones, the railroad, and of course the Red River crisis, and then he had opinions about the Northwest. He's a guy to you can understand all of that through him. Probably at this point, you need it more than you do need the stories of Riel, in my opinion.
It's time for them. It's true.
Says to. Get the picture clear.
Yes.
And a picture, by the way, the cover of this book is great. He's a very striking individual, very impressive individual. Well, Gerald Friesen is a very impressive individual. The book is The Honorable John Norkay, University of Manitoba Press. This has been the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And Riley, thank you very much. See you next week.